This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Economic observations can be, yes, subjective. But now more than ever, what you see depends on what you think. We'll explain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, today, the 26th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We talked on the program on Friday about the Democratic convention last week and the relative lack of economic policy specifics that we heard in it. From the Republicans last night on night two of their convention, the economy got some notable attention, actually, most specifically from Larry Kudlow. He is, of course, the director of the National Economic Council.
Our economic health is coming back. With emergency spending and tax cuts, Americans are going back to work. There's a housing boom, there's an auto boom, a manufacturing boom, a consumer spending boom. Stocks are in record territory. A V-shaped recovery is pointing to better than 20% growth in the second half of this year.
We are going to focus, because this is only a half an hour program, on the veracity of just that last line, the V-shaped 20% bit. Given the baseline it's coming from, the depths of this pandemic's economic shock, there is a whole lot of relativity at work there with Mr. Kudlow. It is still not a healthy economy when we are losing, give or take, a million jobs a week. But there are some positive economic signs out there. Today's numbers on durable goods being the most recent. Nearly double what analysts expected. Orders for stuff meant to last 3 years or more were up more than 11%. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what that might tell us.
Economists and analysts look at orders for durable goods to get a read on how willing people are to spend on big-ticket items that last a few years, like refrigerators, office equipment, and last month, cars. Eric Gordon teaches at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
I think there was pent-up demand in autos. People had been putting it off for a number of months, and the car makers are offering very strong deals.
And the uptick wasn't driven just by cars. Shipments of business machinery were also up.
So we're about the level of capital goods shipments that we were at before the pandemic.
Daniel Bachman is an economic forecaster for Deloitte.
And that I consider to be very positive because it does suggest that U.S. businesses at this point believe that it's worth it for them to continue investing.
Which is good news, at least in the manufacturing sector. Abdu Njai teaches economics at New York University. He says manufacturing, though, isn't the big concern right now.
Because this is not the sector that's hurting. We know that spending on services has plunged, which has been led by a large drop on restaurants and recreation mainly.
And that's because of the pandemic. Here's Bachman at Deloitte again.
It'll be very hard for the economy to really start recovering until we have a solution to the health problem.
But you'll probably still hear politicians talking about a V-shaped recovery right up until Election Day. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Hurricane Laura is bearing down on the Gulf Coast, and wildfires are still burning in Northern California and other parts of the West. The common thread between the two? A whole lot of people have been ordered to leave their homes and find safety someplace else. Evacuations are difficult in normal times, right? But in the middle of a pandemic and a recession, getting out of town with what you need could be even tougher, as Marketplace's Andy Euler tells us.
Taylor Thompson is an attorney in Beaumont, Texas, a town right along Hurricane Laura's path. He says he left town about a day and a half ago to stay with his parents in Austin, but he's not the only one there.
This evacuation makes that social distancing a little harder whenever you have, you know, your grandparents, you know, your mom, who just finished chemotherapy, you know, your dad, and your uncles and aunts all in one house.
He says the economic hardship of leaving town to stay with his parents is minimal for him. He's not married and doesn't have any kids. But Diane Yentel of the National Low Income Housing Coalition says there are certain things individuals need to get out of harm's way.
To evacuate, you need to have a car. You need to have a full tank of gas. You need to be able to potentially rent a motel room for a night or two if the evacuation shelters are full.
And in the aggregate, those evacuation costs for Americans add up.
There is a number. That number is too big for us to count at the moment.
That's Nora O'Brien, an emergency disaster consultant in California. She says it's too big because we have disasters on top of disasters and a health pandemic. She says because these events often straddle state lines, the federal government, along with state and local governments, have to coordinate resources to move folks from the path of a storm or a wildfire. But government spending is only one piece of the pie.
The private sector has a huge role in supporting community recovery when something happens.
And when the evacuation order comes, people just need the resources to get out of a disaster's way. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, neither wildfire nor hurricane nor pandemic nor recessions shall stay these traders from their appointed purchases. More new records when we do the numbers. Natural disasters, as Mr. Euler was just telling us, couldn't care less that there is a pandemic and a recession going on. Another part of the natural world that waits for no one? The apple harvest that they're about 10 days into up in Washington State. Patrick Smith is our resident apple and hops farmer in the Yakima Valley, where his family owns and operates Loftus Ranches. Patrick, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
What's it like harvesting apples in the time of coronavirus, man?
It's interesting. Every year throws a new challenge at us, and this is certainly different than anything we have experienced in the past. A lot of new precautions that we have to take and things that we're doing to keep our people safe and healthy while still getting the crop off in a timely fashion.
Well, one of the things I remember from being up there, which is too many years ago now, I think, and when we can travel again, I'll come back. But you, and this is a whole conversation that I had with you and your dad, the real structure and attention you put into your seasonal labor. How is that going? I mean, can you get people to get the fruit off the trees?
Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, you're welcome to come back anytime. But
thank you.
As far as our seasonal labor force, a significant proportion of the laborers here in central Washington that harvest apples and hops and everything else are H-2A workers, predominantly from Mexico. But with, you know, some of the precautions that are being taken at the border, the consulates are restricting visitors and appointments. And so getting those individuals, their visas has been slower and in some cases is not happening. So that is affecting the supply of labor, but we're hanging in there. We're a little bit short, but we should have enough to do what we need to do.
And then what about pricing? Because the last couple of times we have talked to you, you've been a bit pricing challenged, right? With some of the trade issues and excess fruit and all that. Is it stabilizing? Are you able to get what you need for your fruit now?
I'd say that it's stabilizing. There are some indications that maybe the first of this 2020 harvest that prices are up a little bit, which would certainly be helpful, but it's still very early to tell. I mean, we've only been really harvesting apples here for, you know, 10 days or so. Export volumes have started to come back, but we're probably only halfway back from what we had lost from, you know, 2017 and 2018. Inventory levels in the industry are at record highs right now, so that is presenting a little bit of a challenge. You know, fingers crossed that the export trends continue and that we get some better pricing and better movement.
Yeah. Last thing, and then I'll get out of your hair. What? And it's a little personal, so you can tell me to go pound sand if you want to. But how's the Smith household getting by in times of coronavirus? I mean, you're out in a rural part of the country. What's it like for you guys?
Yeah, tough. I mean, we've got three young kids, and doing school online is a bit of a challenge. My wife operates a preschool here, and So she's been shut down since March, and so that's certainly affecting all of us. We're dealing with a lot of the same challenges on that front as families across the country are, and so I think we're all looking forward to getting the kids back in the classroom when it's safe and appropriate to do so.
Patrick Smith, who with his family runs Loftus Ranches up in Yakima, Washington. Also, they've got a brewery, too. They do good beer as well. Patrick, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Kai. Thank you.
One of the big limits in making progress against the coronavirus, maybe the big limit, actually, other than masks and the not wearing of them, is testing. We don't do enough of it, way less than a million a day, even though a lot of experts say we need five times that or more. So with that kind of demand here and globally for testing machines and all the associated supplies, a lot of university labs, instead of waiting for overloaded commercial companies to catch up, they've created DIY testing systems. Marketplace's Scott Tong checked in with a lab manager at the University of Washington to get a sense of a day in the life of this very essential worker.
When I reached Dr. Alex Greninger at 9 a.m. his time one recent morning, he's already been at work for 90 minutes. He talks not so much like the lab scientist and coronavirus test assistant lab director that he is, but like a shipping clerk tracking his office purchases.
So we're going to, follow those tracking numbers because if they get shipped today, we'll make sure they get shipped today.
This morning, he's running down a testing machine he's bought to boost how many tests his lab can do for the western part of Washington state. Right now, it's maxed out at 7,500 per day. One machine he bought is something called the Roche 8800. It's a long white machine that kind of looks like a row of kitchen appliances on top of cabinets. Runs $750,000, but it's on back order.
We don't even know if we'll ever receive it. Right now, I think the receipt date's been pushed back into December.
And to boost his chances, he also ordered a different model.
And we're told that they couldn't ship them until quarter two of 2021. Yeah, pretty crazy.
Machine shortages are a big reason this lab has to say no to medical offices that want to send human samples to his lab in Seattle. From Florida, from Louisiana, Connecticut.
We're probably turning away more samples than we actually run.
So now he's trying to scale up, and he's talking like an army quartermaster.
The items that you get right now, the weapons that you can get right now, are what you're going to go into battle with going into the fall.
When the weather gets cold and more people gather indoors. At midday, I check in with Alex again.
It's noon on Wednesday here in Seattle.
And voila, a new testing machine has come in. No, it's not the Roche 8800, but it's a different brand. Greninger uses his phone to record what these things sound like. This is good, means they can run more tests. As soon as folks learn how to use this new contraption.
It's really hard on the staff, on everyone, to try to maintain running 6,000 to 7,000 samples a day while you're trying to bring on new platforms.
Each platform, each testing system, requires specific chemicals. They're called reagents, and they're hard to get, especially if you're just a university lab competing against commercial giants like Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp.
Like every other industry, this virus, it concentrates privilege. Larger companies are getting larger, and then that's just how it is.
Later in the day, Greninger turns his attention to the nitty-gritty of his lab's work.
So it's 3:10 p.m. here.
Including a meeting with consultants trying to speed up the workflow and inefficiencies. Test tubes can be ill-fitting. The samples have to be unboxed and labeled, scanned, tracked, checked, and then disposed of, which takes a room full of special containers. Does he ever run out of gas?
In June and some of July, I just got really exhausted and had my own sort of burnout, and you start to feel like a weird lack of motivation.
Now, though, he says he's energized again. The fall season could bring a surge in cases, and his lab will be more important than ever, even if patients don't realize it.
people have probably never met the person who tested their sample. The doctor is the one that communicates the result, in a way takes credit for the result, and the laboratory technicians, scientists, pathologists, people behind the scenes don't really get to interact with the patient that way.
With his day at the testing lab done, Greninger heads out for more work. He walks to a separate research lab to learn more about the virus that he's testing for. Greninger stays till about 9 p.m. or so, and then home to talk a little shop with his wife.
She's also in clinical laboratory over at a competing outfit. We decompress mostly by complaining about the testing process.
More human samples and more lives on the line will be waiting in the morning. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And so before I knew it, my ministry was to start a credit union.
And start one he did. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials found 83 points today, about 0.3%, finished at 28,331. The NASDAQ up 198 points, 1.7%, 11,665. The S&P 500 up 35 points, 1%, 3478. Record highs for the NASDAQ and the S&P. Kimberly talked about the durable goods number a little bit earlier, uptick in demand for cars. So where have auto prices been headed? Kelley Blue Book reported earlier this month that the average price for a new vehicle in July hit about $38,378. That is up something like 2% from July a year ago. Down, though, about 1.2% from the average price in June. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.69%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We would be remiss if we did not mention a big speech coming tomorrow from Fed Chair Jay Powell. The title, Monetary Policy Framework Review, is, I think we can all agree, a tad dry. What it's going to mean in real life, though, says economist Tim Dewey at the University of Oregon, ain't dry at all.
My expectation is the Fed's going to basically loosen up how they've been thinking about their 2% inflation target.
Specifically?
The Fed will actually try to overshoot their 2% target a little bit to make up for periods of undershooting the 2% target.
And that's a big deal because central bankers today are still really, really leery of inflation, flashing back as they do to the 1970s and Paul Volcker and a prime rate of 21.5%. But what is this speech going to mean for you and me?
Where you're going to notice a difference is maybe over the longer run.
Like?
In this recovery, the Fed probably won't raise interest rates as early as it did in the previous recovery. So maybe as a result of that, the recovery is a little bit faster.
And?
That would mean jobs that grew more quickly, that wages that grew more quickly, and then maybe inflation was a little bit higher.
And as so often happens with the Fed, Powell merely talking about higher inflation could just nudge the economy all by itself.
And even the expectation that policy will be easier for longer could actually induce some of us to take economic activity now because it improves our confidence about the future.
Tim Dewey at the University of Oregon there with the setup for Jay Powell's big speech tomorrow on inflation. It's all virtual, by the way, the Fed conference tomorrow. You can watch Powell's speech, should you so choose. Go to the Kansas City Fed's YouTube site, youtube.com/Kansas City Fed. There are few things more important when it comes to building wealth in this economy than access to a bank or some other kind of financial institution. Yet, according to a study by the Federal Reserve a couple of years ago, Black Americans are 3 times more likely to be unbanked or underbanked than whites are. And that leads me to a guy by the name of Bill Bynum. He is the CEO of Hope Credit Union in Jackson, Mississippi. Bynum grew up, though, in Jim Crow, North Carolina.
When I was a kid, my grandmother took me to a credit union that was in the garage of the vice principal of our segregated school in North Carolina. It happened to be in a town called Bynum, which is probably named after someone who owned my ancestors. Mm-hmm. And the credit union provided financial services for black folks in the community that weren't able to go to the local bank.
Bill Bynum eventually made his way to Mississippi, where he kind of created the job he has had ever since.
I actually joined a church here in Jackson, and when I mentioned that I'd worked with credit unions in North Carolina, the minister said that he had been working for a long time to try to address the need for an alternative to the petty lenders and check cashers that were in the neighborhoods surrounding the church. And so before I knew it, my ministry was to start a credit union.
That's a good way to put it, that idea of your ministry being a credit union. Tell me about the communities to which you minister with Hope Credit Union.
Well, the neighborhoods are predominantly African-American, and if you drive through many black neighborhoods here in Jackson or across the Deep South, you'll find plenty of petty lenders and check cashers, but unfortunately, not very many banks. When you have a bank in a community, you're more likely to be able to get a business loan or a mortgage loan and to have a place to go to when your tires are out to get a small dollar loan. Mm-hmm. In the absence of a nest egg to fall back on or friends and family to borrow from, you go to where you can, and too often that's a high-cost financial alternative.
I'm not asking this the right way, but I think you'll understand what I mean. How's business for you at Hope Credit Union? I mean, are you seeing a lot of customers now? Do they need and use your services?
You know, Kai, I think in many ways we're created to be a resource for people in a time of crisis. When you think about low-income communities and communities of color, you're disproportionately going to have people who work in the retail and the service sector. And those have been the sectors that have been hardest hit. And we had to step in and do what we can do to provide a lifeboat. We also have been one of the more active providers of paycheck protection loans. In the normal course of a year, we'll make 40 to 50 business loans. Well, since the PPP program opened, we have made more than 2,500 loans, from 40 loans in a year to 2,500.
Wow. So let me back you out for a minute here and ask you a bigger picture question, because you are, and it's a question about black capitalism, right? Because you are in the heart of a very specific piece of it. What is your sense of black capitalism in this economy today?
You know, black capitalism is a critical part of closing the racial wealth gap. And nothing closes the wealth gap more than ownership. And so when you talk about black capitalism, it is essential that we do more to equip black entrepreneurs to start and grow and thrive. If you look at the wealth gap in America, it's typically $10 to $12 to one is what you typically hear. Well, but for black entrepreneurs, it closes to 3 to 1. It's not where it should be. It should be equal, but 3 to 1 is a lot better than 10 or 12 to one.
Are you hopeful in this moment, Mr. Bynum?
No, I'm a masochistic optimist, I guess. We've been doing this work for a quarter century, and I am glad that more people are focused on closing these gaps. I've heard more conversations about racial justice, about economic opportunity, and about the role of minority depository institutions, quite frankly, in the past several weeks than I've heard in nearly four decades of doing this work. So, yeah, I find optimism, reason for optimism in that.
Mr. Bynum, thanks for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
We did an hour-long special about the racial wealth gap in this country and how to create an economy that works for everybody. It's airing on some local public radio stations. It also lives online, marketplace.org. You can hear the one that David did for the morning show and Molly from Marketplace Tech as well. It's on the the Economy What Now page. This final note on the way out today, Help Wanted Department saw this in Politico this morning. The United States Postal Service, much in the news of late and not necessarily in a good way, is looking for some help in its lobbying shop. They've hired a headhunter, the post office has, to find him a vice president of government affairs and public policy who will, and this is a quote from the job description, guide the development and implementation of the Postal Service's public policy issues at federal and state levels to include legislative goals and strategies, tactics, and messaging. So if that's you and you fancy a move to Washington, D.C., resumes currently being accepted. All right, we are going, but not without your midweek moment of economic context, courtesy today of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In a study out this morning, the chamber says women-owned small businesses have been disproportionately affected by this pandemic. Last month, 62% of male business owners said the overall health of their companies was somewhat or very good. Women, just 47%. Our media production team, and as a reminder, they are the ones going in so the rest of us can work from home. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Talladay, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.